It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Bickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're getting ready to ring in the new year, so today on Central Time, we'll say a fond farewell to 2014 by revisiting some of our favorite interviews from the past year. Coming up later in the show, we'll hear from a researcher who says spending time by water can make us healthier, happier, and more creative.
First, we're taking a look at how parents are navigating social media, especially when it comes to posting pictures and videos of their kids. In days past, the annual holiday card was the one time all year faraway friends and family members had to show off pictures of their kids. But with the widespread adoption of social media sites like Facebook and Instagram, proud parents can upload pictures all year long for everyone to see. But should they?
It's a big debate these days. A growing number of parents are deciding to keep those photos and other references to their kids off the internet. It's what our next guest calls a baby blackout. Aisha Sultan is a syndicated parenting columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. I talked to her back in August about this growing trend, and I began by asking her to define that term, baby blackout.
It's a funny term, but I think it refers to a growing number of parents who decided they really don't want to have a digital footprint for their child. And so they're not posting any pictures or information about their child on social media and have requested parents, you know, other family members and friends to respect their wishes.
And this is not the norm yet, if my Facebook page is any indication. A lot of people put anywhere from some to an insanely large amount of information and photos of babies on up.
Well, you're absolutely right. And, they're very much so in the minority, as anybody with a Facebook feed could attest to. And you're right. Most parents, and this is a research that I did when I was a fellow at the University of Michigan, looked at parental behaviors and how many parents post pictures or share information, achievements, tell stories or brag about their kids on Facebook. And definitely the majority say that they do. And that's how they use things like Facebook and Instagram, is to feel connected to other parents and, you know, to share information about their kids.
And it's easy to see why people do that. We, most parents, like to talk about their kids, show the pictures, whatever. Why the backlash? Why are some parents saying, hey, maybe don't do this so much?
Right. No, that's a great question. And that sort of goes to the heart of the research that I did when I was at Michigan, is that When parents in large numbers started joining social media, they were really the first, their kids were the first generation that were growing up along with the social web, along with having their moments documented in this very public way on Facebook or on YouTube. And so I think it raised, initially, we were just very excited to have a way to connect with family and friends who may not be in our immediate vicinity or who we don't have a chance to talk to as often as we like. And then as sort of time went on, I think the conversation about this changed. We saw a lot more high-profile privacy breaches and realized that our information and our data is really not as secure as some of these sites would like you to believe. I think we also saw consequences that children face themselves of poor choices of things that they'd posted. So we started having this sense of, we don't really know exactly how this information is being used, who's looking at it, and the way this information could be used in the future to make judgments and decisions about our child's life. So I think people became a lot more cautious, and especially, or I'd say, with the conversation about privacy ramping up over the past few years. In the past few years, parents have become a lot more concerned. And I think that's a legitimate, healthy concern to have.
What was it that got you originally interested in this topic of putting kids online?
Well, like you mentioned, I am a parenting columnist, and, you know, part of the nature of being a reporter is that we love to share great stories. And, of course, as a parent, I think my kids are hilarious. And so I was having a conversation with my child, my son, who was 5 years old at the time, and he said something that I thought, of course, was brilliant. So I reached for my computer, and he said to me, "Are you going to put that on Facebook? Because I don't want you to put that, what I just said, on Facebook." And it struck me that even a five-year-old has intellectual property rights. And as a parent, I should respect that. I mean, he's in kindergarten, but at the time he was in kindergarten. But you know what? That was something that he said, and maybe he didn't want the whole world to see it. So for me, that moment really changed the way I looked at how I talked about my kids and shared their information online. Because you know what? we didn't have to grow up with the fear of our parents putting something about us in a permanent record that would always live out there, that other people could see. I mean, they might tell their friends over coffee or at the playground or something, but it wasn't a megaphone that was just permanent like that.
Right. So even a kid who's not savvy enough to think about intellectual property rights, like your five-year-old at the time, can their pictures are out there theoretically 18 years from now and they're in college or they're on a job or something like that? Do they want their diaper pictures to be out there for anybody to find?
Right. And I think it's not even, it doesn't even have to be that far in the future because, you know, kids are much more technically savvy at much younger ages. So even if we put information about them online as toddlers or as, you know, kindergartners, then is that somehow used to market to them when they have their own accounts or in different ways that, you know, we haven't even conceived of yet? Because we know that information is collected and stored and aggregated and sold to somebody for some purpose. You know, it's not just floating out there for free for fun. So I think that, and you know, what's interesting is when people use the choices, the information that we put on social media or on the internet to make decisions about us, I think as consumers and as parents, we have a right to know how that information is being used. And right now, we don't know that.
So for a lot of people, it probably isn't black and white. We're going to put everything online. We're going to put nothing online. How do you see people drawing the lines for themselves on what they post and what family members post?
You're absolutely right. You are 100% right about that. Very few people are on either extreme. And so what things that I do is I won't use their full names. People sometimes will give their kids nicknames that they refer to them online as, or they won't post pictures that they'll find ways to perhaps obscure a child's identity if they're going to talk about them. Another thing is that I think at a very young age, you can ask a child their permission. Because essentially, I mean, I would want someone to ask my permission before they posted something about me if it could potentially embarrass me or if it might be something that I didn't want out there. So I think that's just before you post, think twice about, would this be something that my child would be as a middle schooler, as a high schooler, something that they would want everybody else to have access to?
Well, that sounds like an interesting teachable moment when you're at the stage where you can ask your kid. You're maybe starting to lay the groundwork for when they are independent operators on social media.
And that happens younger and younger. You know, I mean, that happens at a very young age. So, yeah, absolutely. The younger you start having that conversation, hopefully the savvier and better digital citizens they'll be as they grow up.
Now, what about the idea of, okay, I'm going to post lots of stuff online, but I'm going to set my privacy settings so it only goes out to selected, I don't know, friends and family members. Is that enough of a guarantee that it's really only going to them?
I don't really believe in that. I really honestly don't. I mean, I think there's too many ways to work around that, regardless of how secure you think it is. There are ways around just about any sort of secure privacy setting that you put on your accounts. So I think even if you have your account set up very privately, you should just assume that if this made it out into the greater world wide web, would I be comfortable with it?
That's parenting columnist Aisha Sultan talking about the growing trend of the baby blackout, meaning parents posting no pictures of their kids on social media sites. We'll get to the second half of that conversation in just a moment, but we want to hear from you, too. What do you think of this idea of keeping pictures and videos of kids off of social media? Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. Weigh in there.
Right now, here's a look at some of today's headlines from WPR News.
We're talking to parenting columnist Aisha Sultan about the decision to put our kids on Facebook, to post pictures of the baby, the first day of school, you name it, whether to put them up there or not. Aisha, where do you see the trends going? I think more and more people over time are using Facebook and other social media. Are more and more people posting photos of their kids, or are you seeing enough people dial back that it's moving the needle?
You know, I think the most interesting changes I've seen is not just people, more and more parents have said, I want a little more control over this. People are thinking about this before they're posting and having conversations about it with their family members before they post. So I think that will continue. You'll continue to see more of that. But other interesting things, I think lawmakers are now starting to pay attention to this issue too. Like in California, there's a new law that's going to require online services, websites, or apps that collect identifiable information to remove content that minors have posted if it's requested. Hmm. And that goes into effect next year. And I think you'll start to see more attention, regulatory attention also paid to this issue. We saw some of that also here on a national level, although our laws really don't have much teeth in them. But in terms of how are kids marketed to online, how is their information used, because they're still minors. So that might drive some of this conversation in a different direction. Another interesting thing is that schools now also collect a ton of information digitally about children and use that to make decisions about, you know, their class placement and how they're doing, how they're learning. So we're going to start seeing a lot more discussion and questions about how secure that information is, and does it stay with them forever, and how is that used? Even if it's not part of their grades, it's part of an electronic permanent record. So I think as we see so many things in our society become digital, it's going to raise questions about the whole thing, about the security of it, about who has control over it. I like to think that as consumers, we're going to want greater protection of our information because we are the ones who should own that.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Tim on the line in La Crosse. Tim, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my phone call. I'm really glad you're talking about this. My wife and I have knocked out two kids in the last 2 years, and we're in our late 20s. I'm 27. My wife is 26. And we completely left social media for the fact that we didn't want to share that type of information.
You closed your account completely, Tim?
Oh, completely. Both of them.
You could have stayed on and not talked about the kids. You just wanted to go cold turkey and make sure you wouldn't let anything slip there.
Actually, the worst part was family on both sides. We were taking random pictures and posting them that we did not want online.
So how did you ask them not to do that, Tim?
Yes, but they did not listen.
Uh-oh. Well, Tim, thank you so much for that call and for that example. And Aisha, that brings up a great question. Say I'm a parent, I've decided I'm not putting up my kids, I'm not putting up pictures of them on Facebook, but my family is. What's the etiquette there? What's the best way to say, hey, cut it out?
Right. You know, it's funny, Tim, because I sort of found myself in hot water with my own family just a few weeks ago. My sister had a baby, and I was there. Into my family's in Texas, and so I was there visiting when the baby was born, and of course I was tremendously excited. I took a picture of my nephew, and I have a private Instagram account, which is like very limited in the sense that it's only limited to like friends and very close family members. And I posted this picture of his baby without using his name or saying anything. And my brother-in-law said to me, and he got very upset. He was like, can you please ask before you post anything? Because I really don't want any information or any pictures of our kids out there that we haven't chosen ourselves to put out there. And so I think what I had to do was, you know, eat some crow and say, I'm really sorry. I didn't realize, and I should have asked first. And, you know, I took the picture down. But I think it was a sort of a wake-up call for me that you really do have to ask permission no matter how close you are. I mean, this is my sister, this is my nephew, and obviously had no ill intent, but I just instinctively, our reaction now is we see something great or we see this beautiful moment is to want to share it. That's become our knee-jerk, instinctive reaction. And you have to check yourself, or someone else will check you. You know? And that's exactly what happened. So I think if you notice that your family is not going to respect your wishes, then you probably are not left with a whole lot of options other than what Tim and his wife decided to do.
Some kind of witness protection program, maybe. Jill on Facebook writes, My dad is extremely privacy conscious and really made me think about posting info about my children online. I gave my children nicknames when I was pregnant, and that's how I still refer to them. I rarely post pictures. When I do, the pictures are usually of them in the distance or their backs or profiles. So nicknames and blurry or distant photos of them. Is that a common solution?
Well, I think it's more common to not want to put your child's full name or very specific. I mean, it doesn't make sense to put very specific identifying information like birthdays you should be careful about, schools you definitely want to be careful about, or things that would very easily lead to your child, you know, routines, patterns, teams. I mean, there are plenty of people who do and feel fine and safe doing that, but you know, you always be a little bit aware.
We'll go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Tyler on the line in Lindenhurst. Tyler, hi.
Hello. How are you doing, guys?
Good. What do you think about this?
Me, personally, I don't personally see too big of a problem when it comes to, like, posting pictures of, like, your little baby girl or boy. I mean, my friend personally had a child, and she's posted on Facebook. She's only given a select few people to post it to, and everything's gone well. True, I also agree with, I mean, if you're going to post it to, like, family or friends, they're not going to respect your wishes. If you want privacy, then that should be respected, and if not, don't post it. But also, like they were saying, I honestly feel, because, like, I'm in high school right now, we use Facebook and social media as a way to just express ourselves and all these great, happy moments. And that's really what social media should be. I mean, we don't need to put any more solid, just, my name is Tyler something something, or, like, any, like, firm, like, information on there, like, who, nickname, that should all be fine. But really, people should be able to feel safe about posting pictures or sharing that with their loved ones and or friends.
Tyler, thanks a lot for the call. And Tyler, in high school himself, Aisha brings up, I guess, the sequel to our conversation. When and how do we take those kids we haven't been posting pictures of and help them make the leap to social media?
Yeah, I mean, at some point, your child is going to encounter this, whether at school or at a much younger age, because this is how a generation is growing up in communicating with one another, and you cannot remove a child from the way their generation communicates. That's just unrealistic. So, I think, and Tyler made a very good point that this is a way to feel connected, and especially when you're a parent and when you sometimes feel very isolated or like you're the only person going through the challenges that you are, it is a way to feel validated, and it is a way to feel like, you know, you get to share something that can be difficult, and you can feel supported through social media. So I still share things about my kids for my family's benefit, my friend's benefit, and for my own benefit through social media. So I think there's like you said earlier, there is a middle way between putting out too much and then just having an absolute blackout of information.
Tyler, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Rick with us in Grafton. Rick, hi.
How you doing? Well, I've spent over 30 years in the computer industry. I'm an IT director now, and I specialized in online security and banking for many years, managing an international team. So I'm not going to be popular in what I say, but the reality is parents wouldn't show pictures of their children or have their children in a less than friendly place in a big city. And what they got to realize is internationally, very bad people are out there looking for things. And you have to be aware of this. So in my opinion, teens, for example, need to be watched almost more than a toddler, even a high school student. And with my children, I'm a single father. I let them see what the dangers were there. And at any time, I could audit their Facebook or social media and see who they're being friends with. And my daughter many times was shocked that the person on the other side was not who she thought they were. And then my final thought is, when you say friend, make sure it really is a friend. You've interacted with them. They're a friend. You're not doing a popularity thing where you got 500 friends and you really don't know who those people are. Be very conscious of who you're interacting with on Facebook.
Rick, thanks a lot for the call. So Rick's saying whether it's a parent posting or the teenager posting, there are bad people out there. Be careful about that.
I think Rick made an excellent point, because no matter what other types of protections that Facebook or other social media might put on their privacy protections, I don't think it replaces parental conversation, parental oversight. That has to start from day one. And that has to continue, you know, even when your children are teenagers and in high school. And I think by having access, letting them know that you have access to their sites, that you can see who they're talking to, who they're interacting with, is really important. And he's doing a great job.
So a lot of back and forth here. What advice would you give to parents who are trying to decide, they're at the starting point, they want to know what should they post on social media about their kids?
Well, I wouldn't post. For me, this is what I've done, is I don't post my kids' names. I try not to post specifically where they go to school. I try to be vague about their ages or their grades sometimes. And I definitely won't use like any specific team names or where they play certain sports or do certain extracurricular activities. I also try to limit the number of pictures I put up of them. And if I do put a picture, like a previous caller just said, I wouldn't feel comfortable posting anything in a bathing suit or anything like that, which could be looked at in a different way by anybody else. And I do. From a very young age, I've asked them if they're okay with me posting anything that I want to put about them on Facebook or on social media. I'll ask them first. So those are the things I've sort of done. Because I happen to live in a state removed from the rest of my family, and it is hard on a day-to-day basis to not be able to see what your nieces and nephews or, you know, share what's going on in your family with your other family members. So that's the sort of balance I've tried to strike.
Aisha, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
That was Aisha Sultan. She's a parenting columnist at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. She joined us back in August to talk about the debate over posting pictures and videos of kids on social media and the growing trend of what she calls the baby blackout.
Coming up after the news, we'll hear about the science behind why being near water makes us feel good and how time spent near your favorite lake or river can actually lead to better health and increased compassion. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Thanks for joining us here on the last day of 2014. It's been quite a year for us, and we've had a ton of fun covering some of the most interesting and compelling stories of our time. Today, we're looking back on some of our favorite interviews from 2014, including one that reinforced something we suspected all along: being by the water is good for us.
In the 19th century, doctors used to tell patients to go to the seashore to recuperate. Turns out that was some pretty solid medical advice. And according to our next guest, proximity to water, oceans, lakes, rivers has a scientifically proven record for improving things like creativity, health, and our sense of compassion. We'd like to hear from you. Is your brain happier when you're near water? Why do you think that is? Head on over to the Central Time Facebook page. Leave your thoughts there.
Wallace J. Nichols joins us now. He's a research associate at the California Academy of Science and founder-director of Ocean Revolution, also the author of the book Blue Mind. He joined us back in July to share the science behind the joy we get from being in or around the water, something he describes as blue mind. That was a new term for us, so I started the interview by asking him to define it.
Well, it's a shorthand for the feeling you have when you step up to the edge of the water, where you feel relaxed, where you feel clear, where maybe you feel more connected to the person that you're with. And it's just an overall good, happy feeling that many of us have when we go on vacation or at the end of a long day when we take a break by a lake or a river, or in the case of us out here in California by the ocean. So we just call that overall state of mind, blue mind.
That sounds like something sort of intangible, just sort of a general feel-good feeling that people get when they're near water because it's relaxing. But you say there's actual science behind the idea of blue mind. What do we know about why water is good for us?
Yeah, we used to think it was intangible. And then, you know, we entered the modern age of neuroscience, or the golden years of neuroscience. And now we're able to look inside the brain and check out our brain chemistry, look at our physiology. And if we want to spend a little more money, put people in the lab and have a look at their brain patterns. And what we find is that when you're standing in front of blue space, when you're standing in front of water, your heart rate slows, your breathing rate slows, you relax a bit more, your brain produces a set of feel-good chemicals. And that's in contrast to what we call red mind, which is the agitated state that we're often in throughout the day with deadlines and emails and perhaps traffic or screaming kids, and stepping out of that red mind into blue mind and just relaxing for a bit changes our chemistry, changes our bodies, changes our brains, and we can do certain things a little bit better, such as creativity, insight, innovation, perhaps writing poetry or coming up with a brand new idea. A lot of people throughout the ages have found that sitting in the bathtub, floating down a river, or maybe bathing in the ocean has opened them up to new ways of thinking. And now we're understanding exactly how that works.
So it's not just oceans. Obviously, you know, the ocean is a majestic example of what water can be, but you're saying the benefits are there for lakes, for rivers, for streams.
Yeah, absolutely. So I went to high school in Illinois next to Lake Michigan, and I know that in Wisconsin, you know, with the 15,000 lakes and 84,000 miles of river, a lot of people are spending time next to those kinds of bodies of water and getting their blue minds on. And the key thing, the key message is, if the lakes and the rivers and the oceans and the bays are not healthy, we won't get our blue mind on. We'll go there and it'll make us sad. It'll make us maybe a little edgy because we remember those places being places we could swim or recreate. And when that is taken away from us, not only do we lose the ecological benefits of healthy waterways, but we also lose the cognitive and emotional and social benefits of those waters. And that's really the underlying message, I think, of the book.
So this is really about also conservation, about why humans should care about water beyond just the fact that we don't want pollution. You're saying it physiologically affects our well-being.
Yeah, if you imagine your town with its lakes and rivers and ponds and perhaps coastlines, and imagine if you couldn't go there. Imagine if you couldn't access that water in a safe way. Imagine it was cut off from you and your family, or when you got there, it was in bad shape. You would lose more than just money. You lose more than just the ecological costs, which are both true. You lose all these other, often referred to as softer benefits. But in fact, they're what make life worth living. You know, we celebrate our weddings and funerals. We propose to each other. We have our best memories, our funnest moments in summertime, splashing around in water in many cases. And imagine that taken away. And I think that's even makes our argument for healthy waterways even more powerful. And when we could put science behind these feelings, these emotions, these intangibles, it makes them more tangible and gives us a more powerful argument in policy settings for protecting our lakes and our rivers and our oceans.
Well, let's dig into some of that science. When we look at it from that perspective, what exactly happens inside our brains and our bodies, let's say, when we go for a dip in Lake Superior?
Well, you know, we know that cortisol is a stress hormone. We know that when we're under a lot of pressure and a lot of stress, our bodies produce cortisol, and that's really important. The red mind is a very important reaction to the world around us. But if we have sustained high levels of cortisol, sustained stress, that becomes toxic, and scientists and doctors refer to that as toxic stress. It interferes with our health, and 60% of modern diseases and illnesses are connected to stress. So as we become more and more stressed out and we're unable to manage it, we get sick or we don't heal. Now contrast that with the blue mind state. When you take a break at the end of a day or in the middle of a day or during the summer, during vacation, and you step out of the daily grind and you're able to relax and feel that water washing over you, go for a swim in the lake, then you're reducing your stress level. And that has massive implications for your health. Now, we can't do it every day. We can't be on vacation all the time. But we can find proxies for that feeling. So that may be taking a bath or having a photograph of that favorite water place on your wall or as a screensaver or going back and looking at videos from your vacation and sinking into that feeling once in a while and getting away from it all, because we can't be out there all the time. Unless, of course, you're a marine biologist, you can spend a little more time on the ocean. So basically, cortisol management or stress management is a big part of it. But it goes beyond that. And when we're at the water, it holds our attention. And scientists and psychologists call that soft fascination. So water keeps our interest. You know, you talk to people and they'll sit by the water for their entire vacation. And you ask, what did you do? And they'll say, I just sat and looked at the water. I really love sitting and looking at the water, and it doesn't get boring. It's always changing, and it's always interesting. And throughout the day, it holds our attention, whether it's a river or a lake or the ocean. And it holds us in that relaxed state where our heart rate is lower, where our breathing rate is lower, where our blood pressure is lower. And that's really good. It holds you in that relaxed state. And when you're in that state, your brain shifts over to what scientists call the default mode network. And that's a brain network that is much, much more aligned with self-referential thinking, insight, innovation, and creativity versus the more active mode network that we're experiencing during the day, where we're solving the problems that are right in front of us, where we're attending to the noise and the conversations and the emails, which is a much more active mode. Now we're in this what's called the default mode, and we're relaxing, and we're having a, some people describe it as a feeling of oneness. And it turns out when you have that kind of feeling, following that, you're much more likely to engage in empathetic or compassionate activities. You're much more likely to see yourself as part of the whole versus just a single individual. And so that's another outcome of this Blue Mind experience.
You make it sound meditative. And didn't I read that you said water meditates you? So instead of you trying to come at it from that approach, water does it for you.
Yeah, that's right. It's a mildly meditative state. And it turns out physiologically, it's similar to what happens when people meditate. Although you don't need to know how to meditate. All you need to know is where the water is and need to get out and experience it. So the water does meditate us.
That's Wallace J. Nichols. He's the author of Blue Mind. He's making the case that being in and around bodies of water can be good for our health, our happiness, and also inspire us to be more creative and compassionate. What do you think about this idea? Head on over to the Central Time Facebook page and let us know.
We'll pick up with the second half of that interview in a moment. First, a look at the headlines with WPR News. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Wallace J. Nichols, a research associate at the California Academy of Science. He's got a new book out called Blue Mind.
And we want to hear from you. What does water do for you when you're on the ocean, the river, the lake, the stream? Do you feel calmer, happier, nicer? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org.
I'm going to go to our phones now and take Sherry from Milwaukee. Hi, Sherry.
Yeah, hi. I was listening to the conversation with great interest. I recently learned to swim, or swim better, I should say, this last summer. And I'm going to do a sprint triathlon in August. So I've been practicing swimming, and I always try to explain to people that I feel like the water stays with me all day. You know, when the days that I swim, I feel it's indescribable, but I feel the water with me all day. I feel at ease. I feel more comfortable. And it's a feeling that stays with me for the entire day. And also, the days that I swim, if I run the next day, my asthma is better. It's not as bad. So I find that interesting too. So I don't know how the water helps that. But I hate getting wet, but I love once I'm in the water.
Oh, Sherry, thank you so much for sharing that. You're making me want to go swimming. I bet that sounds familiar to you, Jay.
Very familiar. You know, you hear the same thing. You have friends that surf out here in cold water, and sometimes they say, you know what, I'm not even enjoying surfing in this cold water, but when I get out of the water, I feel so good all day that it's worth it. So it's kind of a therapy. And sometimes you just, you know, you swallow that pill, you get in the water, the Blue Mind pill, and then you have the benefits that last some, you know, all day, sometimes all week. And you know, surfers call it the surfer stoke. And I imagine there's a similar term for swimmers in Wisconsin to that. Yeah, for sure.
Jay, isn't there a program that uses water therapy with veterans?
Yes, we work very closely with several organizations, and one of them is called Heroes on the Water. And they use kayak therapy and kayak fishing as a way to get veterans sort of outside in motion and on the water. And, you know, if you've ever been kayak fishing, you know that you do spend a lot of time sitting on the water, neither kayaking nor fishing, but waiting. And that time is very relaxing. And for folks with post-traumatic stress, that's, you know, really important to be able to relax. There's another group called Operation Surf, and they use surfing and teaching veterans to surf as a way of doing the same thing. And some of the men and women who participate in these programs report that they sleep for the first time that night after these activities, that they're much more relaxed, that they can consider at least dialing back some of the medications that they're on and reducing their dosages and reducing the side effects that some of those prescription drugs can cause. And so I'm always very careful to point out this is certainly not a silver bullet solution to the all of the modern ills and the things that keep us awake at night. But over and over, we hear stories from really all corners of society that being out on or in the water, even near the water, does help them live a better life. So something to consider.
Thank you for that call. We're going to go next to Bob in Green Bay. Hi, Bob.
Hello. I just wanted to call in, and I, listening to the program, I absolutely, unequivocally agree with the blue mind theory. I just wanted to say quick that I worked about 5-6 years corporate America. I absolutely felt the red mind, and I kind of snapped. I went out and bought a sailboat and moved on to a boat. Now I live on the water in Florida, and it is the best move I've ever made in my life.
Huh. That sounds pretty great. So what is it about being on the boat, Bob, that you feel?
I just, everything that is mentioned before, calmness, heartbeat slows down. As soon as I step onto the boat and everything kind of flows with the water, the ebb and flow of it, blood pressure drops instantly. So now I'm to the point where I don't even like getting on land. I just prefer staying on my boat the whole time. It's wonderful.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for sharing that, Bob. And Jay, not everyone can live on a boat. In Wisconsin, we run into some ice issues, but what are some ways we can get near to the water and enjoy some of what Bob's got?
Well, certainly seasonally, that's an activity that everyone can work to participate in. And I think one of the keys is to always try to take someone with you, maybe someone who doesn't have a boat or has never really thought of checking out the Great Lakes and rivers. It also reminded me, I was hoping somebody from Green Bay would call in because my mom grew up in Green Bay, and she's had a lifelong fear of water. And it was just kind of strange considering the work that I do. And recently at her 50th anniversary, we were all together in Hawaii with my mom and dad, and my daughters and I got her into the ocean for the first time in 50 years.
What happened?
Really. And she was very nervous, but my daughters and I held her up, and she floated on her back. And I have to say, I've never seen her so relaxed in my entire life. She just floated on her back in this nice, warm Hawaiian ocean, and it was a great moment. And she wants to get back. She wants to get back in the ocean. She's always loved sitting and looking at the water, but never wanted to get into it due to some early life experiences in pools and lakes, and that didn't go so well. Kids jumping on her and stuff, and she has had a lifelong fear of water. But now she's back, and a little bit later in life, but we'll see her in swimming a little bit more than we have for the past 50 years.
So. Oh, that's a fantastic story. And let's go next to Joe. Joe is joining us in Prairie du Chien. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I'm a scuba diver, and I completely agree with this whole idea. It's wonderful to be underwater and just completely buoyant or neutral. But my question would be, you mentioned blue in your research, and does the sky have the same effect? Or is it the fact that we're terrestrial beings and water's a liquid in an unfamiliar environment that creates this effect?
Really good questions, Joe. I'm glad you brought up the color blue. Jay, what does that have to do with it in the sky?
That's a great question. And I think one of the observations is not all water looks blue. Some of the great places to swim are brownish or greenish, or sometimes swimming at night, it's anything but blue. And so it is the color. There's lots of research on color psychology that suggests that blue light does have an effect on our brains. That's different from other colors and other qualities of light. So looking at the sky, particularly if it's a clear blue sky, is appealing. But one of the things you lose when you're looking at a solid color, a blue wall or a blue sky or a blue screen, is the dynamic interaction. So the water is changing. So it's not just the color, although it is the color. it's also the sound. It's not just the sound and the color. It's also the feel. And it's that dynamic, the light bouncing off of the surface of the water, creating this changing kind of mosaic of color and light. So it's all of these things put together. But to understand them, in the book, we kind of unpack it, and we take on each of the senses, we take on each of these elements, and then try to wrap it all back together into this concept we call Blue Mind. So you can have these kinds of feelings like taking a hike in the forest or climbing a mountain and looking at the vista. And we find that people have a lot of happiness and get a lot of joy, have a lot of stress reduction hiking in the forest. And it's even more if the forest has a creek or a river or a lake, or the destination of that hike is water. So yes to green space, yes to open sky, yes to stars and moon, and add water to that situation. Looking at the stars, looking at the sunset, looking at the sky by the water, even better. So, you know, we kind of joke a bit and say, just add water to any situation, and it'll make it more fun. So if you have a balloon, it's fun, but if you have a water balloon, it's really fun, and it just changes the party.
Oh, fantastic. We're going to leave it there. Jay, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm really, really happy to speak with you, and great calls from your listeners.
That was Wallace J. Nichols, Research Associate at the California Academy of Science and Founder Director of Ocean Revolution. He's the author of the book Blue Mind. He joined us back in July to talk about how being in and around water can make us happier and healthier. Tomorrow on Central Time, we'll kick off 2015 with a live show chock full of good stuff, including a look at the top news stories of the day.
If you could opt out of eating food, would you? We'll talk about emerging food projects such as Soylent, which promise all the nutrients you need in pill or powder form without the work of cooking.
And on Friday, we'll be joined by a consultant from the hit TV show Downton Abbey. He'll talk about the work that goes into making the show look historically accurate as well as completely stylish.
And speaking of stylish, our assistant news director Noah Ovshinsky joins us. He'll have a look at what's ahead in state politics in 2015.
That's all coming up this week on Central Time. Coming up tomorrow on The Joy Cardine Show, what do the words selfie, twerking, and hashtag have in common? Well, they've all made this year's banished words list, meaning the words we all wish would just simply be eliminated from the English language. We'll hear what else made that list and your suggestions tomorrow morning after 6 on The Joy Cardine Show.